worried.
I didn't say you shouldn't worry. Do you think I don't worry? But no, you probably can't do anything about me. I saw him opening his mouth to disagree. Then he changed his mind and laughed again. He reached out and popped an orange segment into my mouth.
Well, maybe no, Sassenach, and maybe so. But I've lived a long enough time now to think it maybe doesn't matter so much. So long as I can love you.
Speechless with orange juice, I stared at him in surprise.
And I do, he said softly.
He leaned into the berth and kissed me, his mouth warm and sweet. Then he drew back and gently touched my cheek.
Rest now, he said firmly. I'll bring you some broth in a bit.
I slept for several hours and woke up, still feverish, but hungry. Jamie brought me some of Murphy's broth, a rich green concoction swimming in butter and reeking with sherry, and insisted, despite my protests, on feeding it to me with a spoon. I have a perfectly good hand, I said crossly.
Aye, and I've seen you use it too,
he replied, deftly gagging me with a spoon.
If you're clumsy with a spoon as with that needle, you'll have this all spilt down your bosom and wasted, and Murphy will brain me with a ladle. Here, open up.
I did, my resentment gradually melting into a sort of warm and glowing stupor as I ate. I hadn't taken anything for the pain in my arm, but as my empty stomach expanded in grateful relief, I more or less quit noticing it.
Will you have another bowl? Jamie asked as I swallowed the last spoonful. You'll need your strength kept up.
Not waiting for an answer, he uncovered the small tureen Murphy had sent and refilled the bowl.
Where's Ishmael?
I asked during the brief hiatus.
On the after deck. He didn't seem comfortable below decks, and I can't say I blame him, having seen the slavers at Bridgetown. I had Maitland sling him a hammock.
Do you think it's safe to leave him loose like that? What kind of soup is this? The last spoonful had left a delightful lingering taste on my tongue. The next revived the full flavour.
Turtle. Stern took a big hawk spill last night. He sent word he's saving you the shell to make combs of for your hair.
Jamie frowned slightly, whether at the thought of Lawrence Stern's gallantry or Ishmael's presence I couldn't tell.
As for the black, he's not loose. Fergus is watching him.
Fergus is on his honeymoon, I protested. Shouldn't make him do it. Is this really turtle soup? I've never had it before. It's marvellous.
Jamie was unmoved by contemplation of Fergus's tender state. Aye, well, he'll be wed a long time, he said callously. Do him no harm to keep his breeches on for one night. And they do say that abstinence makes the heart grow firmer, no?
Absence, I said, dodging the spoon for a moment. And fonder. If anything's growing firmer from abstinence, it wouldn't be his heart.
That's very bawdy talk for a respectable married woman, Jamie said reprovingly, sticking the spoon in my mouth. And inconsiderate forby.
I swallowed. Inconsiderate?
I'm a wee bit firm myself at the moment, he replied evenly, dipping and spooning. What were you sitting there with your hair loose and your nipples staring me in the eye, the size of cherries?
I glanced down involuntarily, and the next spoonful bumped my nose. Jamie clicked his tongue and, picking up a cloth, briskly blotted my bosom with it. It was quite true that my shift was made of thin cotton, and even when dry, reasonably easy to see through.
It's not as though you haven't seen them before, I said, amused.
He laid down the cloth and raised his brows.
I've drunk water every day since I was weaned, he pointed out. It doesn't mean I canna be thirsty still.
He picked up the spoon.
You'll have a wee bit more.
No thanks, I said, dodging the oncoming spoon. I want to hear more about this firmness of yours.
No, you don't. You're ill.
I feel much better, I assured him. Shall I have a look at it? He was wearing the loose petticoat breeches the sailors wore, in which he could easily have concealed 3 or 4 dead mullet, let alone a fugitive firmness.
"You shall not," he said, looking slightly shocked. "Someone might come in, and I kind of think your looking at it would help a bit."
"Well, you can't tell that until I have looked at it, can you?" I said. "Besides, you can bolt the door."
"Bolt the door? What do you think I'm going to do? Do I look the sort of man would take advantage of a woman who's not only wounded and boiling with fever, but drunk as well?" he demanded.
He stood up, nonetheless.
"I'm not drunk," I said indignantly. "You can't get drunk on turtle soup."
Nonetheless, I was conscious that the glowing warmth in my stomach seemed to have migrated somewhat lower, taking up residence between my thighs, and there was undeniably a slight lightness of head, not strictly attributable to fever.
"You can if you've been drinking turtle soup as made by Aloysius O'Shaughnessy Murphy," he said. "By the smell of it, he's put at least a full bottle of the sherry in it. A very intemperate race, the Irish."
"Well, I'm still not drunk." I straightened up against the pillows as best as I could.
"You told me once that if you could still stand up, you weren't drunk."
"You aren't standing up," he pointed out.
"You are. And I could if I wanted to."
"Stop trying to change the subject.
We were talking about your firmness." "Well, you can just stop talking about it because..."
He broke off with a small yelp as I made a fortunate grab with my left hand.
"Clumsy, am I?"
I said, with considerable satisfaction. "Oh, my. Heavens, you do have a problem, don't you?"
"Will you leave go of me?"
he hissed, looking frantically over his shoulder at the door.
"Someone could come in at any moment." "I told you should have bolted the door," I said, not letting go.
Far from being a dead mullet, the object in my hand was exhibiting considerable liveliness. He eyed me narrowly, breathing through his nose.
"I wouldn't have used force on a sick woman," he said through his teeth. "But you've a damn healthy grip for someone with a fever, Sassenach. If you..."
"I told you I felt better," I interrupted. "But I'll make you a bargain. You bolt the door, and I'll prove I'm not drunk." I rather regretfully let go, to indicate good faith. He stood staring at me for a moment, absent-mindedly rubbing the sight of my recent assault on his virtue. Then he lifted one ruddy eyebrow, turned, and went to bolt the door. By the time he turned back, I had made it out of the berth and was standing, a trifle shakily, but still upright, against the frame. He eyed me critically.
"It's no going to work, Sassenach," he said, shaking his head.
He looked rather regretful himself.
"We'll never stay upright with a swell like there is underfoot tonight. And you know I'll not fit in that berth by myself, let alone with you."
There was a considerable swell. The lantern on its swivel bracket hung steady and level, but the shelf above it tilted visibly back and forth as the Artemis rode the waves. I could feel the faint shudder of the boards under my bare feet, and knew Jamie was right. At least he was too absorbed in the discussion to be seasick.
"There's always the floor," I suggested hopefully.
He glanced down at the limited floor space and frowned.
"Aye, well, there is. But we'd have to do it like snakes, Sassenach, all twined round each other amongst the table legs."
"I don't mind."
"No,"
he said, shaking his head.
"It would hurt your arm."
He rubbed a knuckle across his lower lip, thinking. His eyes passed absently across my body at about hip level, returned, fixed, and lost their focus. I thought the bloody shift must be more transparent than I realized. Deciding to take matters into my own hands, I let go my hold on the frame of the berth and lurched the 2 paces necessary to reach him. The roll of the ship threw me into his arms. He barely managed to keep his own balance, clutching me tightly round the waist.
"Jesus," he said,
staggered, and then, as much from reflex as from desire, bent his head and kissed me. It was startling. I was accustomed to be surrounded by the warmth of his embrace,
Now it was I who was hot to the touch, and he who was cool. From his reaction, he was enjoying the novelty as much as I was. Light-headed and reckless with it, I nipped the side of his neck with my teeth, feeling the waves of heat from my face pulsate against the column of his throat. He felt it too.
God, you're like holding a hot coal.
His hands dropped lower and pressed me hard against him.
Firm, is it?
Ha! I said, getting my mouth free for a moment.
Take those baggy things off.
I slid down his length and onto my knees in front of him, fumbling mazily at his flies. He freed the laces with a quick jerk, and the petticoat breeches ballooned to the floor with a whiff of wind. I didn't wait for him to remove his shirt, just lifted it and took him. He made a strangled sound, and his hands came down on my head as though he wanted to restrain me, but hadn't the strength.
"Oh, Lord," he said.
His hands tightened in my hair, but he wasn't trying to push me away.
"This must be what it's like to make love in hell," he whispered, "with a burning she-devil."
I laughed, which was extremely difficult under the circumstances. I choked and pulled back a moment, breathless.
"Is this what a succubus does, do you think?" "I wouldn't have doubted it for a moment," he assured me.
His hands were still in my hair, urging me back. A knock sounded on the door, and he froze.
Confident that the door was indeed bolted, I didn't.
"Aye, what is it?"
he said, with a calmness rather remarkable for a man in his position.
"Fraser?"
Lawrence Stern's voice came through the door.
"The Frenchman says the black is asleep, and may he have leave to go to bed now."
"No," said Jamie shortly.
"Tell him to stay where he is. I'll come along and relieve him in a bit."
"Oh."
Stern's voice sounded a little hesitant.
"Surely. His wife seems eager for him to come now."
Jamie inhaled sharply.
"Tell her,"
he said, a small note of strain becoming evident in his voice,
"that he'll be there. Presently."
"I will say so."
Stern sounded dubious about Masali's reception of this news, but then his voice brightened.
"Ah, is Mrs. Fraser feeling somewhat improved?"
"Very much,"
said Jamie with feeling.
"She enjoyed the turtle soup?"
"Greatly, I thank you."
His hands on my head were trembling.
"Did you tell her that I've put aside the shell for her? It was a fine hawksbill turtle, a most elegant beast."
Aye, I did."
With an audible gasp, Jamie pulled away and, reaching down, lifted me to my feet.
"Good night, Mr. Stern," he called.
He pulled me toward the berth. We struggled four-legged to keep from crashing into tables and chairs as the floor rose and fell beneath us.
"Oh."
Lawrence sounded faintly disappointed.
"I suppose Mrs. Fraser is asleep, then?"
"Laugh, and I'll throttle you,"
Jamie whispered fiercely in my ear.
"She is, Mr. Stern,"
he called through the door.
"I shall give her your respects in the morning, aye?"
"I trust she will rest well. There seems to be a certain roughness to the sea this evening."
"I have noticed, Mr. Stern."
Pushing me to my knees in front of the berth, he knelt behind me, groping for the hem of my shift. A cool breeze from the open stern window blew over my naked buttocks, and a shiver ran down the backs of my thighs.
"Should you or Mrs. Fraser find yourself discommoded by the motion, I have a most capital remedy to hand. A compound of mugwort, bat dung, and the fruit of the mangrove. You have only to ask, you know."
Jamie didn't answer for a moment.
"Oh, Christ,"
he whispered. I took a sizable bite of the bedclothes.
"Mr. Fraser?" "I said, thank you,"
Jamie replied, raising his voice.
"Well, I shall bid you a good evening, then."
Jamie let his breath out in a long shudder that wasn't quite a moan.
"Mr. Fraser?"
"Good evening, Mr. Stern,"
Jamie bellowed.
Good evening."
Stern's footsteps receded down the companionway, lost in the sound of the waves that were now crashing loudly against the hull. I spit out the mouthful of quilt. "Oh, my God!" His hands were large and hard and cool on my heated flesh.
"You've the roundest ass I've ever seen."
A lurch by the Artemis, here aiding his efforts to an untoward degree, I uttered a loud shriek.
"Shh!"
He clasped a hand over my mouth, bending over me so that he lay over my back, the billowing linen of his shirt falling around me, and the weight of him pressing me to the bed. My skin, crazed with fever, was sensitive to the slightest touch, and I shook in his arms, the heat inside me rushing outward as he moved within me. His hands were under me then, clutching my breasts, the only anchor as I lost my boundaries and dissolved, conscious thought a displaced element in the chaos of sensations, the warm damp of tangled quilts beneath me, the cold sea wind and misty spray that wafted over us from the rough sea outside, the gasp and brush of Jamie's warm breath on the back of my neck, and the sudden prickle and flood of cold and heat as my fever broke in a dew of satisfied desire. Jamie's weight rested on my back, his thighs behind mine. It was warm and comforting. After a long time, his breathing eased, and he rose off me. The thin cotton of my shift was damp, and the wind plucked it away from my skin, making me shiver. Jamie closed the window with a snap, then bent and picked me up like a rag doll. He lowered me into the berth and pulled the quilt up over me.
"How's your arm?" he said.
"What arm?" I murmured drowsily. I felt as though I had been melted and poured into a mould to set.
"Good," he said,
a smile in his voice.
"Can you stand up?"
"Not for all the tea in China."
"I'll tell Murphy you liked the soup."
His hand rested for a moment on my cool forehead, passed down the curve of my cheek in a light caress, and then was gone. I didn't hear him leave. Chapter 57 Promised Land.
"It's persecution,"
Jamie said indignantly. He stood behind me, looking over the rail of the Artemis. Kingston Harbour stretched to our left, glowing like liquid sapphires in the morning light, the town above half sunk in jungle green, cubes of yellowed ivory and pink rose quartz in a lush setting of emerald and malachite. And on the cerulean bosom of the water below floated the majestic sight of a great three-masted ship, furled canvas white as gull wings, gun decks proud and brass gleaming in the sun. His Majesty's man of war, Porpoise.
"The filthy boots pursuing me," he said, glaring at it as we sailed past at a discreet distance, well outside the harbour mouth. "Everywhere I go, there it is again."
I laughed, though in truth the sight of the Porpoise made me slightly nervous too.
"I don't suppose it's personal," I told him. "Captain Leonard did say they were bound for Jamaica." "Aye, but why would they know head straight to Antigua, where the naval barracks and the navy shipyards are, and them in such straits as you left them?"
He shaded his eyes, peering at the Porpoise. Even at this distance, small figures were visible in the rigging, making repairs. "They had to come here first," I explained. "They were carrying a new governor for the colony." I felt an absurd urge to duck below the rail, though I knew that even Jamie's red hair would be indistinguishable at this distance.
"Aye. I wonder who's that?"
Jamie spoke absently. We were no more than an hour away from arrival at Jared's plantation on Sugar Bay, and I knew his mind was busy with plans for finding young Ian.
"A chap named Gray," I said, turning away from the rail.
"Nice man. I met him on the ship just briefly."
"Gray?"
Startled, Jamie looked down at me.
"Not Lord John Gray, by chance?"
Yes, that was his name. Why?
I glanced up at him, curious. He was staring at the porpoise with renewed interest.
Why?
He heard me when I repeated the question a second time, and glanced down at me, smiling.
Oh, it's only that I ken Lord John. He's a friend of mine.
Really?
I was no more than mildly surprised. Jamie's friends had once included the French Minister of Finance and Charles Stuart, as well as Scottish beggars and French pickpockets. I suppose it wasn't remarkable that he should now count English aristocrats among his acquaintance, as well as Highland smugglers and Irish sea cooks.
Well, that's luck, I said. Or at least I suppose it is. Where do you know Lord John from?
He was the governor of Ardsmuir Prison, he replied, surprising me after all.
His eyes were still fixed on the porpoise, narrowed in speculation.
And he's a friend of yours?
I shook my head.
I never understand men.
He turned and smiled at me, taking his attention at last from the English ship.
Well, friends are where you find them, Sassnach, he said.
He squinted toward the shore, shading his eyes with his hand.
Let us hope this Mrs. Abernathy proves to be one.
As we rounded the tip of the headland, a lithe black figure materialised next to the rail. Now clothed in spare seaman's clothes, with his scars hidden, Ishmael looked less like a slave and a good deal more like a pirate. Not for the first time, I wondered just how much of what he had told us was the truth.
"I be leaving now," he announced abruptly.
Jamie lifted one eyebrow and glanced over the rail into the soft blue depths.
"Dinna let me prevent you," he said politely. "But would ye not rather have a boat?"
Something that might have been humour flickered briefly in the black man's eyes, but didn't disturb the severe outlines of his face.
"You say you put me ashore where I want. I be telling you about those boys," he said.
He nodded toward the island, where a riotous growth of jungle spilled down the slope of a hill to meet its own green shadow in the shallow water.
"That be where I want."
Jamie looked thoughtfully from the uninhabited shore to Ishmael, and then nodded.
"I'll have a boat lowered."
He turned to go to the cabin.
"I promised you gold as well, no?" "Don't be wanting gold, mon."
Ishmael's tone, as well as his words, stopped Jamie in his tracks. He looked at the black man with interest, mingled with a certain reserve.
"He'll have something else in mind."
Ishmael jerked his head in a short nod. He didn't seem outwardly nervous, but I noticed the faint gleam of sweat on his temples, despite the mild noon breeze.
"I be wanting that one-armed nigger."
He stared boldly at Jamie as he spoke, but there was a diffidence under the confident facade.
"Temeraire?"
I blurted out in astonishment.
"Why?"
Ishmael flicked a glance at me, but addressed his words to Jamie, half bold, half cajoling.
"He ain't no good to you, mon. Can't be doing field work or ship work neither. Ain't got but one arm."
Jamie didn't reply directly, but stared at Ishmael for a moment. Then he turned and called for Fergus to bring up the one-armed slave.
This ends Disc 30. Voyager, Disc 31.
Temeraire, brought up on deck, stood motionless as a block of wood, barely blinking in the sun. He too had been provided with seaman's clothes, but he lacked Ishmael's raffish elegance in them. He looked like a stump upon which someone had spread out washing to dry.
"This man wants you to go with him to the island there," Jamie said to Temeraire in slow, careful French. "Do you want to do this thing?"
Temeraire did blink at that, and a brief look of startlement widened his eyes. I suppose that no one had asked him what he wanted in many years, if ever. He glanced warily from Jamie to Ishmael and back again, but didn't say anything. Jamie tried again.
You do not have to go with this man, he assured the slave. You may come with us and we will take care of you. No one will hurt you. But you can go with him if you like.
Still the slave hesitated, eyes flicking right and left, clearly startled and disturbed by the unexpected choice. It was Ishmael who decided the matter. He said something in a strange tongue full of liquid vowels and syllables that repeated like a drumbeat. Temeraire let out a gasp, fell to his knees and pressed his forehead to the deck at Ishmael's feet. Everyone on deck stared at him, then looked at Ishmael, who stood with arms folded with a sort of wary defiance.
"He be going with me," he said.
And so it was. Picard rowed the two blacks ashore in the dinghy and left them on the rocks at the edge of the jungle, supplied with a small bag of provisions, each equipped with a knife.
"Why there?"
I wondered aloud, watching the two small figures make their way slowly up the wooded slope. "There aren't any towns nearby, are there? Or any plantations?"
To the eye, the shore presented an unbroken expanse of jungle.
"Oh, there are plantations," Lawrence assured me. "Far up in the hills, that's where they grow the coffee and indigo. The sugar cane grows better near the coast."
He squinted toward the shore where the two dark figures had disappeared.
"It is more likely that they've gone to join a band of Maroons, though," he said.
"There are Maroons on Jamaica as well as on Hispaniola?"
Fergus asked, interested.
Lawrence smiled a little grimly.
"There are Maroons wherever there are slaves, my friend," he said. "There are always men who prefer to take the chance of dying like animals rather than live as captives."
Jamie turned his head sharply to look at Lawrence, but said nothing. Jared's plantation at Sugar Bay was called Blue Mountain House, presumably for the sake of the low, hazy peak that rose inland a mile behind it, blue with pines and distance. The house itself was set near the shore, in a shallow curve of the bay. In fact, the veranda that ran along one side of the house overhung a small lagoon. The building, set on sturdy, silvered wood pilings that rose from the water, crusted with a spongy growth of tunicates and mussels, and the fine green seaweed called mermaid's hair. We were expected. Jared had sent a letter by a ship that left Le Havre a week before the Artemis. Owing to our delay on Hispaniola, the letter had arrived nearly a month in advance of ourselves, and the overseer and his wife, a portly, comfortable Scottish couple named MacIvers, were relieved to see us.
"I thought surely the winter storms had got you,"
Kenneth MacIver said for the fourth time, shaking his head. He was bald, the top of his head scaly and freckled from long years' exposure to the tropic sun. His wife was a plump, genial, grandmotherly soul, who, I realised to my shock, was roughly 5 years younger than myself. She herded Massali and me off for a quick wash, brush and nap before supper, while Fergus and Jamie went with Mr. MacIver to direct the partial unloading of the Artemis's cargo and the disposition of her crew. I was more than willing to go. While my arm had healed sufficiently to need no more than a light bandage, it had prevented me from bathing in the sea, as was my usual habit. After a week aboard the Artemis unbathed, I looked forward to fresh water and clean sheets with a longing that was almost hunger. I had no land legs yet. The worn wooden floorboards of the plantation house gave the disconcerting illusion of seeming to rise and fall beneath my feet, and I staggered down the hallway after Mrs. MacIver, bumping into walls. The house had an actual bathtub in a small porch, wooden, but filled mirabile dictu with hot water. By the good offices of two black slave women who heated kettles over a fire in the yard and carried them in. I should have felt much too guilty at this exploitation to enjoy my bath, but I didn't. I wallowed luxuriously, scrubbing the salt and grime from my skin with a loofah sponge and lathering my hair with a shampoo made from chamomile, geranium oil, fat soap shavings, and the yolk of an egg, graciously supplied by Mrs. MacIver. Smelling sweet, shiny-haired, and languid with warmth,
I collapsed gratefully into the bed I was given. I had time only to think how delightful it was to stretch out at full length before I fell asleep. When I woke, the shadows of dusk were gathering on the veranda outside the open French doors of my bedroom, and Jamie lay naked beside me, hands folded on his belly, breathing deep and slow. He felt me stir and opened his eyes. He smiled sleepily, and reaching up a hand, pulled me down to his mouth. He had had a bath, too. He smelled of soap and cedar needles. I kissed him at length, slowly and thoroughly, running my tongue across the wide curve of his lip, finding his tongue with mine in a soft, dark joust of greeting and invitation. I broke loose finally and came up for air. The room was filled with a wavering green light, reflections from the lagoon outside, as though the room itself were under water. The air was at once warm and fresh, smelling of sea and rain, with tiny currents of breeze that caressed the skin. "You smell sweet, Sassenach," he murmured, voice husky with sleep. He smiled, reaching up to twine his fingers into my hair. "Come here to me, Curlywig." Freed from pins and freshly washed, my hair was clouding over my shoulders in a perfect explosion of Medusa-like curls. I reached up to smooth it back, but he tugged gently, bending me forward so the veil of brown and gold and silver fell loose over his face. I kissed him, half smothered in clouds of hair, and lowered myself to lie on top of him, letting the fullness of my breast squash gently against his chest. He moved slightly, rubbing, and sighed with pleasure. His hands cupped my buttocks, trying to move me upward enough to enter me. "Not bloody yet," I whispered. I pressed my hips down, rolling them, enjoying the feel of the silky stiffness trapped beneath my belly. He made a small, breathless sound. "We haven't had room or time to make love properly in months," I told him. "So we're taking our time about it now, right?" "You take me at something of a disadvantage, Sassenach," he murmured into my hair. He squirmed under me, pressing upward. "You didn't think we could take our time next time?" "No, we couldn't," I said firmly. "Now, slow. Don't move." He made a sort of rumbling noise in his throat, but sighed and relaxed, letting his hands fall away to the sides. I squirmed lower on his body, making him inhale sharply, and set my mouth on his nipple. I ran my tongue delicately round the tiny nub, making it stand up stiff, enjoying the coarse feel of the curly auburn hairs that surrounded it. I felt him tense under me, and put my hands on his upper arms to hold him still while I went on with it, biting gently, sucking and flicking with my tongue. A few moments later, I raised my head, brushed my hair back with one hand, and asked, "What's that you're saying?" He opened one eye. "The rosary," he informed me. "It's the only way I'm going to stand it." He closed his eyes and resumed murmuring in Latin, "Ave Maria, gratia plena." I snorted and went to work on the other one. "You're losing your place," I said, next time I came up for air. "You said the Lord's Prayer 3 times in a row."
"I'm surprised to hear I'm still making any sense at all."
His eyes were closed, and a dew of moisture gleamed on his cheekbones. He moved his hips with increasing restiveness.
"No."
"Not yet." I dipped my head lower, and seized by impulse, went pfft into his navel. He convulsed, and taken by surprise, emitted a noise that could only be described as a giggle.
"Don't do that," he said.
"Will if I want to," I said, and did it again. "You sound just like Bree," I told him. "I used to do that to her when she was a baby. She loved it."
"Well, I'm no a wee bairn if you hadna noticed the difference,"
he said a little testily.
"If you must do that, At least try a bit lower, eh?
I did. You don't have any hair at all at the tops of your thighs, I said, admiring the smooth white skin there. Why is that, do you think?
The cow licked it all off last time she milked me, he said between his teeth. For God's sake, Sassenach!
I laughed and returned to my work. At last I stopped and raised myself on my elbows. I think you've had enough, I said, brushing hair out of my eyes. You haven't said anything but Jesus Christ over and over again for the last few minutes. Given the cue, he surged upward and flipped me onto my back, pinning me with the solid weight of his body.
You're going to live to regret this, Sassenach, he said with a grim satisfaction.
I grinned at him, unrepentant.
Am I?
He looked down at me, eyes narrowed.
Take my time, was it? You'll beg for it before I've done with you.
I tugged experimentally at my wrists, held tight in his grasp, and wriggled slightly under him with anticipation.
Oh, mercy, I said. You beast.
He snorted briefly and bent his head to the curve of my breast, white as pearl in the dim green water light. I closed my eyes and lay back against the pillows.
Paternoster qui es in caelis, I whispered.
We were very late to supper. Jamie lost no time over supper in asking about Mrs. Abernathy of Rose Hall.
Abernathy? MacIver frowned, tapping his knife on the table to assist thought. Aye, seems I've heard the name, though I canna just charge my memory. Oh, you ken Abernathy's fine, his wife interrupted, pausing in her instructions to a servant for the preparation of the hot pudding. It's that place up the Yala's River in the mountains. Cane mostly, but a wee bit of coffee too. Oh, aye, to be sure, her husband exclaimed. What a memory you've got, Rosie.
He beamed fondly at his wife.
Well, I might not have brought it to mind myself, she said modestly, only as how that minister over to New Grace Kirk last week was asking after Mrs. Abernathy, too.
What minister is this, ma'am?
Jamie asked, taking a split roast chicken from the huge platter presented to him by a black servant.
Such a fine braw appetite as you have, Mr. Fraser, Mrs. MacIver exclaimed admiringly, seeing his loaded plate. It's the island air does it, I expect.
The tips of Jamie's ears turned pink.
I expect it is, he said carefully, not looking at me.
This minister. Oh, hi. Campbell was his name, Archie Campbell.
I started, and she glanced quizzically at me.
You'll know him.
I shook my head, swallowing a pickled mushroom. I've met him once in Edinburgh.
Oh, well, he's come to be a missionary and bring the heathen blacks to the salvation of our Lord Jesus.
She spoke with admiration and glared at her husband when he snorted.
Now you'll no be making your papist remarks, Kenny. The Reverend Campbell's a fine holy man and a great scholar forby. I'm free church myself, she said,
leaning toward me confidingly.
My parents disowned me when I wed Kenny, but I told them I was sure he'd come to see the light sooner or later.
A lot later, her husband remarked,
spooning jam onto his plate. He grinned at his wife, who sniffed and returned to her story.
So, 'twas on account of the Reverend's being a great scholar that Mrs. Abernathy had written him, whilst he was still in Edinburgh, to ask him questions. And now that he's come here, he had it in mind to go and see her. Though, after all, Myra Dalrymple and the Reverend Davis telt him. I should be surprised he'd set foot on her place, she added primly.
Kenny MacIver grunted, motioning to a servant in the doorway with another huge platter.
I wouldn't have put a great deal of stock in anything the Reverend Davis says myself, he said. The man's too godly to shit. But Myra Dalrymple's a sensible woman. Ouch!
He snatched back the fingers his wife had just cracked with a spoon and sucked them.
What did Miss Dalrymple have to say of Mrs. Abernathy?
Jamie inquired, hastily intervening before full-scale marital warfare could break out. Mrs. MacIver's colour was high, but she smoothed the frown from her brow as she turned to answer him.
"Well, a great deal of it was no more than ill-natured gossip," she admitted. "The sorts of things folk will always say about a woman as lives alone. That she's our fond of the company of her men slaves, aye?"
"But there was the talk when her husband died," Kenny interrupted.
He slid several small rainbow-striped fish off the platter the stooping servant held for him.
"I mind it well, now I come to think on the name."
Barnabas Abernethy had come from Scotland and had purchased Rose Hall 5 years before. He had run the place decently, turning a small profit in sugar and coffee, causing no comment among his neighbours. Then, 2 years ago, he had married a woman no one knew, bringing her home from a trip to Guadeloupe.
"And 6 months later, he was dead," Mrs. MacIver concluded with grim relish.
"And the talk is that Mrs. Abernethy had something to do with it?" Having some idea of the plethora of tropical parasites and diseases that attacked Europeans in the West Indies, I was inclined to doubt it myself. Barnabas Abernethy could easily have died of anything from malaria to elephantiasis. But Rosie MacIver was right. Folk were partial to ill-natured gossip.
"Poison," Rosie said, low-voiced, with a quick glance at the door to the kitchen. "The doctor who saw him said so. Mind, it could have been the slave woman. There was talk about Barnabas and his female slaves, and it's more common than folk like to say for a plantation cook girl to be slipping something into the stew, but..."
She broke off as another servant came in, carrying a cut-glass relish pot. Everyone was silent as the woman placed it on the table and left, curtsying to her mistress.
"You needn't worry," Mrs. MacIver said reassuringly, seeing me look after the woman. "We've a boy who tastes everything before it's served. It's all quite safe."
I swallowed the mouthful of fish I had taken with some difficulty.
"Did the Reverend Campbell go to see Mrs. Abernethy then?" Jamie put in.
Rosie took the distraction gratefully. She shook her head, agitating the lace ruffles on her cap.
"No, I'm sure not, for 'twas the very next day there was the stramash about his sister."
In the excitement of tracking Ian and the Bruja, I had nearly forgotten Margaret Jane Campbell.
"What happened to his sister?" I asked, curious. "Why, she's disappeared."
Mrs. MacIver's blue eyes went wide with importance. Blue Mountain House was remote, some 10 miles out of Kingston by land, and our presence provided an unparalleled opportunity for gossip.
"What?"
Fergus had been addressing himself to his plate with single-minded devotion, but now looked up, blinking.
"Disappeared? Where?"
"The whole island's talking of it,"
Kenny put in, snatching the conversational ball from his wife.
"Seems the Reverend had a woman engaged as Abigail to his sister, but the woman died of a fever on the voyage."
"Oh, that's too bad." I felt a real pang for Nellie Cowden with her broad, pleasant face.
"Aye,"
Kenny nodded offhandedly.
"Well, and so the Reverend found a place for his sister to lodge. Feeble-minded, I understand."
He lifted a brow at me. "Something like that."
"Aye, well, the lass seemed quiet and biddable, and Mrs. Forrest, who had the house where she lodged, would take her to sit on the veranda in the cool part of the day. So, Tuesday last, a boy comes to say as Mrs. Forrest is wanted quick-like to come to her sister, who's having a child. And Mrs. Forrest got flustered and went straight off, forgetting Miss Campbell on the veranda. And when she thought of it and sent someone back to see, why, Miss Campbell was gone, and not a smell of her since, in spite of the Reverend raising heaven and earth, as you might say."
MacIver rocked back on his chair, puffing out his sun-mottled cheeks. Mrs. MacIver wagged her head, ing mournfully.
"Myra Dalrymple told the Reverend as how he should go to the Governor for help to find her," she said. "But the Governor's scarce settled, and not yet ready to receive anyone. He's having a great reception this coming Thursday for to meet all the important folk of the island. Myra said as the Reverend must go and speak to the Governor there.
But he's no of a mind to do that, being such a worldly occasion, aye?
A reception?
Jamie set down his spoon, looking at Mrs. MacIver with interest.
Is it by invitation, do you know?
Oh, no, she said, shaking her head. Anyone may come as likes to, or so I've heard.
Is that so?
Jamie glanced at me, smiling.
What do you think, Sassenach? Would you care to step out with me at the governor's residence?
I stared at him in astonishment. I should have thought that the last thing he would wish to do was to show himself in public. I was also surprised that he would let anything at all stop his visiting Rose Hall at the earliest opportunity.
It's a good opportunity to ask about Ian, no? He explained. After all, he might not be at Rose Hall, but someplace else on the island.
Well, aside from the fact that I've nothing to wear, I temporised, trying to figure out what he was really up to.
Oh, that's no trouble, Rosie MacIver assured me. I've one of the cleverest sempstresses on the island. She'll have you tricked out in no time.
Jamie was nodding thoughtfully. He smiled, eyes slanting as he looked at me over the candle flame.
Violet silk, I think, he said.
He plucked the bones delicately from his fish and set them aside.
And as for the other, the Nafash Sassenach, I've something in mind. You'll see.
Chapter 58 Mask of the Red Death.
Oh, who is that young sinner with the handcuffs on his wrist? And what has he been after that they groan and shake their fists? And wherefore is he wearing such a conscience-stricken air? Oh, they're taking him to prison for the colour of his hair.
Jamie put down the wig in his hand and raised one eyebrow at me in the mirror.
I grinned at him and went on, declaiming with gestures. "'Tis a shame to human nature, such a head of hair as his. In the good old time, 'twas hanging for the colour that it is. Though hanging isn't bad enough, and flaying would be fair, for the nameless and abominable colour of his hair.
"'Did you not tell me you'd studied for a doctor, Sassenach?' he inquired. "'Or was it a poet, after all?'
"'Not me,' I assured him, coming to straighten his stock. "'Those sentiments are by one A.E. Houseman.'
"'Surely one of him is sufficient,' Jamie said dryly, given the quality of his opinions.
He picked up the wig and fitted it carefully on his head, raising little puffs of scented powder as he poked it here and there.
"'Is Mr. Houseman an acquaintance of yours, then?'
"'You might say so.'
I sat down on the bed to watch.
It's only that the doctor's lounge at the hospital I worked at had a copy of Houseman's collected works that someone had left there. There isn't time between calls to read most novels, but poems are ideal. I expect I know most of Houseman by heart now.
He looked warily at me, as though expecting another outburst of poetry, but I merely smiled at him, and he returned to his work. I watched the transformation in fascination. Red-heeled shoes and silk stockings clocked in black, grey satin breeches with silver knee buckles, snowy linen with Brussels lace 6 inches deep at cuff and jabot. The coat, a masterpiece in heavy grey with blue satin cuffs and crested silver buttons, hung behind the door, awaiting its turn. He finished the careful powdering of his face, and licking the end of one finger, picked up a false beauty mark, dabbed it in gum arabic, and affixed it neatly near the corner of his mouth.
"There," he said, swinging about on the dressing stool to face me. "Do I look like a red-headed Scottish smuggler?"
I inspected him carefully from full-bottomed wig to Morocco-heeled shoes.
"You look like a gargoyle," I said.
His face flowered in a wide grin. Outlined in white powder, his lips seemed abnormally red, his mouth even wider and more expressive than it usually was.
"No," said Fergus, indignantly, coming in time to hear this. "He looks like a Frenchman." "Much the same thing," Jamie said, and sneezed.
Wiping his nose on a handkerchief, he assured the young man,
"Begging your pardon, Fergus."
He stood up and reached for the coat, shrugging it over his shoulders and settling the edges.
In 3-inch heels, he towered to a height of 6'7". His head nearly brushed the plastered ceiling. "I don't know," I said, looking up at him dubiously. "I've never seen a Frenchman that size." Jamie shrugged, his coat rustling like autumn leaves.
"Aye, well, there's no hiding my height. But so long as my hair is hidden, I think it'll be all right. Besides," he added, gazing with approval at me, "folk will not be looking at me. Stand up and let me see, aye?"
I obliged, rotating slowly to show off the deep flare of the violet silk skirt. Cut low in the front, the décolletage was filled with a froth of lace that rippled down the front of the bodice in a series of V's. Matching lace cascaded from the elbow-length sleeves in graceful white falls that left my wrists bare. "Rather a pity I don't have your mother's pearls," I remarked. I didn't regret their lack. I had left them for Brianna in a box with the photographs and family documents. Still, with a deep décolletage and my hair twisted up in a knot, the mirror showed a long expanse of bare neck and bosom, rising whitely out of the violet silk.
"I thought of that."
With the air of a conjurer, Jamie produced a small box from his inside pocket and presented it to me, making a leg in his best Versailles fashion. Inside was a small gleaming fish, carved in a dense black material, the edges of its scales touched with gold.
"It's a pin," he explained. "You could maybe wear it fastened to a white ribbon round your neck."
"It's beautiful," I said, delighted. "What's it made of? Ebony?"
"Black coral," he said. "I got it yesterday when Fergus and I were in Montego Bay."
He and Fergus had taken the Artemis round the island, disposing at last of the cargo of bat guano delivered to its purchaser. I found a length of white satin ribbon, and Jamie obligingly tied it about my neck, bending to peer over my shoulder at the reflection in the mirror.
"No, they won't be looking at me," he said. "Half of them will be looking at you, Sassenach, and the other half at Mr. Willoughby."
"Mr. Willoughby? Is that safe? I mean..." I stole a look at the little Chinese, sitting patiently cross-legged on a stool, gleaming in clean blue silk, and lowered my voice. "I mean, they'll have wine, won't they?" Jamie nodded.
"And whisky, and cambric, and claret cup, and port, and champagne punch, and a wee cask of the finest French brandy, contributed by the courtesy of Monsieur Étienne Marcel de Provac Alexandre."
He put a hand on his chest and bowed again in an exaggerated pantomime that made me laugh.
"Nay worry," he said, straightening up. "He'll behave, or I'll have his coral globe back. Will I know you, wee heathen?" he added, with a grin to Mr. Willoughby.
The Chinese scholar nodded with considerable dignity. The embroidered black silk of his round cap was decorated with a small carved knob of red coral, the badge of his calling restored to him by the chance encounter with a coral trader on the docks at Montego, and Jamie's good nature.
"You're quite sure we have to go?"
The palpitations I was experiencing were due in part to the tightness of the stays I was wearing, but in greater degree to recurring visions of Jamie's wig falling off, and the reception coming to a complete stop as the entire assemblage paused to stare at his hair before calling en masse for the Royal Navy.
"Aye, we do,"
he smiled at me reassuringly.
"Dunna worry, Sassenach. If anyone's there from the Porpoise, it's no likely they'll recognise me. Not like this."
"I hope not. Do you think anyone from the ship will be there tonight?"
"I doubt it."
He scratched viciously at the wig above his left ear.
"Where'd you get this thing, Fergus? I believe it's got lice."
"Oh, no, my lord," Fergus assured him. "The wigmaker from whom I rented it assured me that it had been well dusted with hyssop and horse nettle to prevent any such infestations."
Fergus himself was wearing his own hair, thickly powdered, and was handsome, if less startling than Jamie, in a new suit of dark blue velvet. There was a tentative knock at the door, and Massali stepped in.
She too had had her wardrobe refurbished, and glowed in a dress of soft pink with a deep rose sash. She glowed somewhat more than I thought the dress accounted for, in fact, and as we made our way down the narrow corridor to the carriage, pulling in our skirts to keep them from brushing the walls, I managed to lean forward and murmur in her ear, "Are you using the tansy oil?" "Hmm?" she said absently, her eyes on Fergus as he bowed and held open the carriage door for her. "What did you see?" "Never mind," I said, resigned. That was the least of our worries at the moment. The governor's mansion was ablaze with lights. Lanterns were perched along the low wall of the veranda and hung from the trees along the paths of the ornamental garden. Gaily dressed people were emerging from their carriages on the crushed shell drive, passing into the house through a pair of huge French doors. We dismissed our own, or rather, Jared's carriage, but stood for a moment on the drive, waiting for a brief lull in the arrivals. Jamie seemed mildly nervous, for him. His fingers twitched now and then against the grey satin, but his manner was outwardly as calm as ever. There was a short reception line in the foyer. Several of the minor dignitaries of the island had been invited to assist the new governor in welcoming his guests. I passed ahead of Jamie down the line, smiling and nodding to the mayor of Kingston and his wife. I quailed a bit at the sight of a fully decorated admiral next in line, resplendent in gilded coat and epaulettes. But no sign of anything beyond a mild amazement crossed his features as he shook hands with the gigantic Frenchman and the tiny Chinese who accompanied me. There was my acquaintance from the Porpoise. Lord John's blonde hair was hidden under a formal wig tonight, but I recognised the fine, clear features and slight muscular body at once. He stood a little apart from the other dignitaries, alone. Rumour had it that his wife had refused to leave England to accompany him to this posting. He turned to greet me, his face fixed in an expression of formal politeness. He looked, blinked, and then broke into a smile of extraordinary warmth and pleasure. "Mrs. Malcolm," he exclaimed, seizing my hands, "I'm vastly pleased to see you." "The feeling is entirely mutual," I said, smiling back at him. "I didn't know you were the governor last time we met. I'm afraid I was a bit informal." He laughed, his face glowing with the light of the candles in the wall sconces. Seen clearly in the light for the first time, I realised what a remarkably handsome man he was.
"You might be thought to have had an excellent excuse," he said.
He looked me over carefully.
"May I say that you are in remarkable fine looks this evening? Clearly the island air must agree with you somewhat more than the miasma of shipboard. I had hoped to meet you again before leaving the Porpoise, but when I inquired for you, I was told by Mr. Leonard that you were unwell. I trust you are entirely recovered."
"Oh, entirely," I told him, amused.
"Unwell, eh? Evidently Tom Leonard was not about to admit to losing me overboard.
I wondered whether he had put my disappearance in the log. May I introduce my husband?" I turned to wave at Jamie, who had been detained in animated conversation with the Admiral, but who was now advancing toward us, accompanied by Mr. Willoughby. I turned back to find the governor gone green as a gooseberry. He stared from Jamie to me and back again, pale as though confronted by twin spectres. Jamie came to a stop beside me and inclined his head graciously toward the governor.
"John," he said softly, "it's good to see you, man."
The governor's mouth opened and shut without making a sound.
"Let us make an opportunity to speak a bit later," Jamie murmured. "But for now, my name is Etienne Alexandre."
He took my arm and bowed formally.
"And may I have the pleasure to present to you my wife, Claire," he said aloud, shifting effortlessly into French.
"Claire?"
The governor looked wildly at me. "Claire?"
Yes, I said, hoping he wasn't going to faint. He looked very much as though he might, though I had no idea why the revelation of my Christian name ought to affect him so strongly. The next arrivals were waiting impatiently for us to move out of the way.